One of the features that characterizes many poorer, or what we used to call third world, nations is uneven development. Typically, there is one region or population center, often highly urbanized, that is wealthier and regarded as more modern than the rest of the nation, and whose population, or at least a segment of it, has a higher standard of living than the inhabitants of other regions. And let me say, we're of course used to the idea of inequalities often in the same space. Within the same city, for example, you'll have very poor people and very rich people. But what I'm really talking about here is uneven geographic development, so that people within a particular region are likely to have a higher standard of living, in some cases dramatically higher standards of living, than people in another region of the same country. Indeed, even within wealthier nations, there are often severe regional inequalities. Until recently, you had, for example, the dramatic divisions, reflections in an array of income, health, and production statistics between the north and south of Italy, or even really in the north and south of the United States. And indeed, certain southern states continue to constantly be at the very end of the list of wealthiest and poorest states in the United States. But I would argue that this unevenness tends to be even more dramatic in the case of poorer nations, and that it has a range of implications for politics, social policies, and the production of what we might call difference. The story of São Paulo's meteoric rise to political and economic dominance within the Brazilian nation is an especially extreme example of what I have just described. São Paulo is today Brazil's most populous state. It has close to 40 million people. So just to give you a sense of its size, the country of Colombia and the state of São Paulo have about the same population. Even within Latin America, where uneven development and dramatic regional inequalities are nothing unusual, the speed with which São Paulo sprinted ahead of the other Brazilian states to become first the major exporting region and then the center of industrial production stands out as extraordinary. If you had asked someone traveling in Brazil during the early 19th century which region of Brazil would emerge as clearly dominant by the early 20th century, it is extremely unlikely he or she, but usually travelers were he in that period, he would have chosen São Paulo. It was a colonial backwater with only modest towns, a small port, and limited agriculture. A mark of its economic backwardness or stagnation, and I always use the term backwardness in quotes, but I won't stop using it because people think about it as backwardness even when they don't say it. A mark of its economic backwardness or stagnation was the tendency to use indigenous or Indian slaves in contrast to the more profitable plantation zones, which relied on the more expensive African slave trade for a labor supply. Yet by the middle of the 19th century, the coffee boom was radically transforming the province of São Paulo, as coffee plantations worked by now African or Afro-Brazilian slaves spread at an unprecedented pace. So a sign of São Paulo's increased prosperity was the shift from indigenous slaves to African slaves, who were much more expensive to purchase. Then through a canny use of state revenues to subsidize immigrant labor and sustain high coffee prices, the Paulista elites, and the term Paulista refers to people from São Paulo, the Paulista elites not only managed to avoid the boom-bust cycle that afflicted so many other export economies in Latin America, but also avoided the feared financial losses from the abolition of slavery, and then began the transition to a full-fledged manufacturing region. In some ways, São Paulo completely defies a certain kind of model that was constructed by sort of political economists in the 1960s and 70s about dependency and underdevelopment in Latin America, where the assumption was that the more a region participated in export oriented economic activities, the less likely it was to develop an industrial sort of autonomous economy. And in fact, the exact opposite happened. São Paulo is able to make the transition from an export-dominated economy to an industrialized economy. By the 1940s, the state of São Paulo was the most important industrial center in all of Latin America, as well as Brazil's leading agricultural producer. So one of the things that's striking about São Paulo's economic success is even as it's becoming the most important industrial center, it also is maintaining its position as the most important agricultural center. It is leading production in every single major area of the economy in Brazil. And there were years when the total amount of taxes collected from the state of São Paulo, if we take away the federal district, which included the Port of Rio, the amount of taxes collected in the state of São Paulo was greater than all the other states of Brazil put together. Historians and social scientists have suggested all sorts of reasons for the stunning economic success of São Paulo. In my research, what I am most interested in are those explanations for the region's prosperity, whether in scholarly tracts or in common knowledge, that have emphasized the region, that emphasized the special characteristics of the Paulista people. An explanation, I would argue, that easily lends itself to racist discourses of order and progress. In these narratives, certain inherently modern features, and modern, I think, as you'll see, my argument is that modern is then gets associated with white and European. Certain modern features of the Paulista people teleologically explain their homeland's eventual triumph as the most modern of Brazilian regions. That is, in terms of the teleological aspect of it, that is, key elements of the society São Paulo eventually became already existed in microcosm in an earlier historical period. And there's sort of an inevitable emergence of São Paulo as the dominant region. São Paulo's modernity is therefore treated as a precondition as well as a consequence of its economic progress. And I want to make that point clear. Obviously, it becomes the most industrialized area of Brazil. You'd look at it and say, it's the most modern. But the point is not that its industrialization makes it the most modern, but that it was already inherently had the greatest aptitude for modernity and therefore becomes the most modern. Now, this, of course, is not my argument. This is the argument I'm critiquing. And the Paulistas are correspondingly represented as the most modern, industrious, and orderly of Brazil's regional populations. Let me say, they're also sometimes presented as the dullest, most boring of Brazil's regional populations. So there's a downside to being orderly and industrious in terms of regional stereotypes. My contention, furthermore, is that São Paulo's progressive qualities have been consistently linked to whiteness and to a deliberate expunging of people of color from the historical narrative or from the population designated as Paulista. And here I should be clear about it. There are, you might say, anybody who lives in the state of New York is a New Yorker. Therefore, anybody who lives in the state of São Paulo is a Paulista. And one of my arguments is that that's not the case. That in order to be a Paulista, you have to have certain qualities, and that people who do not have those qualities or are regarded as not having those qualities are not necessarily or automatically regarded as Paulistas, even if they're living in São Paulo. And I'll just quickly give the most obvious example, which is the many people starting in the 1930s who migrated to São Paulo from the northeast of Brazil, a much poorer region, a much less industrialized region of Brazil. Those people tended to be treated like guest workers in their own country. That is, they weren't regarded as Paulistas, they were regarded as nordestinos, northeasterners living in São Paulo and working in São Paulo, but not actually Paulistas. Now, just as an explanatory note, one of the things that I think is interesting about looking at this construction of Paulista identity as a kind of white identity is that it's occurring more or less simultaneously with the emergence in Brazil of what becomes known as the idea of Brazil as a racial democracy. And some of you may be familiar with this construction that Brazil is regarded, particularly in comparison to the United States, as a racially harmonious society. Now, scholars have more recently been frontally attacking this famous myth of racial democracy for concealing the day-to-day discrimination that people of African descent and people of color in general suffer in Brazil, and for delegitimizing political mobilization around racial identities. So one of the aspects of the idea of racial democracy was the idea that people of color don't need to organize and protest in Brazil because there's no racism in Brazil. So in a sense, sort of saying we don't have to deal with problems of racism because they don't exist. If you talk about racism, you're creating problems of racism. So people have paid a lot of attention to this issue of racial democracy, have attacked it as a myth, but they have paid less attention to the role of the myth of racial democracy in obscuring another widespread assumption of Brazilian life, an assumption that São Paulo embodies Brazilian modernity and that the color of modernity is white. To be sure, Brazilian popular culture celebrates the intensely African-influenced religious and artistic practices of Bahia, the multiracial beauty and sophistication of Rio de Janeiro, and romanticizes the exotic indigenous traditions of the Amazon. But discourses of national progress and social welfare have all foregrounded those regions of Brazil that have embodied modern processes of industrialization and efficient agricultural production. Indeed, the very success of São Paulo and the other southern states of Brazil has positioned them as not typical or traditional, but as a different sort of Brazilian reality, one characterized by an exceptional colonial experience, a timely infusion of European immigrants, and a virtual elimination. And by this I mean a virtual, in the sense, the computer sense of, the internet sense of virtual, because of course there are many people of color in São Paulo, but they are eliminated in a representative sense as opposed to a real sense. A virtual elimination of populations associated with backwardness or damaging colonial legacies. Again, this is not my argument. I don't think these populations are associated with backwardness, but that is the way they are represented within this discourse of São Paulo's modernity. This regional exceptionalism is not peculiar to São Paulo. It also appears in the historical narratives of other Latin American nations. In the case of Colombia, there was a long tradition of Antioqueño exceptionalism, Antioquia being a region, a province of Colombia, whose capital is Medellin. And many of you are probably familiar with Medellin as a kind of capital of the drug trade. But in fact, for a long time, Medellin was regarded as the most progressive and modern city in Colombia, and the Antioqueños, the people of that province, were known as the Yankees of Colombia. Most recently, this tendency has manifested itself in the Santa Cruz region of Bolivia, where the population has defined itself as more industrious and less indigenous than the people of the Bolivian highlands. Indeed, racialized claims to regional superiority are not restricted to Latin America. Even today, many northern Italians treat people from southern Italy as if they were of a different racial stock. As should be apparent, these invidious comparisons do not merely describe one region as richer and the other as poorer, which is something that is indisputable in Brazil, that the northeast of Brazil is poorer than São Paulo. Rather, they portray one as more civilized or advanced, the other as more barbarous or backward. In the language of economic development, there is always potential for slippage between explaining underdevelopment as a result of impersonal factors versus an emphasis on inherent features of a society that condemn it to languishing behind other regions or nations. I mean, everybody does this mental process. I mean, it's very difficult to pick up anything, even often in scholarly texts, that, for example, would talk about Japan's stunning success in industrializing and modernizing in the late 19th, early 20th century, that doesn't talk about the sort of the discipline and industriousness of the Japanese people, which by implication says that people who didn't experience this success were less disciplined, were less industrialists, were less had less capacity for modernity. So in discussions of development and underdevelopment, there's always this tendency to talk in terms of inherent qualities that allow one region to develop and another not to develop. I would argue that this potential slippage is particularly likely when uneven development manifests itself within national boundaries. Because we're used to thinking about, you know, the United States as a developed country and Bolivia as an underdeveloped country. But what if you're talking about two regions within the same nation, one of which is, in a sense, a first world area in terms of its standard of living, and another that is a third world area in terms of its standard of living? When it's within the same national boundaries, it becomes the terrain of political struggle and contention over fiscal resources, not to mention discourses of national identity. So once you have an issue, the issue arising within national boundaries, for example, the question becomes, should the nation's resources be used to even out the standard of living? Should it be channeled toward the poorer areas to bring up their standard of living? Or is that throwing good money after bad? Whereas in the case of the United States, we might give some development aid to this country and that country, but it's kind of up to us whether or not we do it. And we don't necessarily, we're not forced to give development aid any place we don't want to do it. Within a national context, there is real contention over who gets access to what. Uneven development of economic and technological resources between nations may produce a United States that sees itself as overwhelmingly dominant in the Western Hemisphere, but only uneven development within a nation can produce the image of São Paulo, very common image in São Paulo, as the locomotiva, the locomotive, a shiny modern engine hauling a train of empty boxcars. So obviously the empty boxcars are the other regions of Brazil. And I don't have a representation of the locomotiva, but I do have another, oops, upside down. I'll get it. These are two cartoons that were widely distributed in a period that I will be talking about when São Paulo was having conflicts with the federal government. And the one on top, and these are a little hard to see, I wish I could make them a little bigger. The one on top basically shows a modern car on your right, and it's being blocked. It's the path it's on, the road it's on is called Progresso, progress. And its path is being blocked by an ox cart. And obviously the car is São Paulo, it says São Paulo on the side, and the ox cart is the rest of Brazil. So not only is São Paulo more modern than the rest of Brazil in this depiction, but its progress is being slowed down. You know, the rest of Brazil is a ball and chain on São Paulo. And then the one on the bottom, São Paulo is the milk cow producing revenue, and the rest of those little babies on the ground are the other states of Brazil feeding off São Paulo's wealth. Now, my objective in this talk is to explore some of the ways in which the Paulistas, and in this case, I'm talking mainly about journalists, historians, essayists, and politicians, in the decades from the 1920s to the 1950s, explained their home region's special status within Brazilian society and its peculiar vocation for the modern way of life. With varying degrees of explicitness, all of these accounts of São Paulo's rise to economic dominance portray a region that is racially different from the Brazil to the north of São Paulo, whether in a cultural or biological sense. Although very few were explicitly separatist, even during São Paulo's short-lived civil war against the federal government in 1932, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, most of the opinion makers I will discuss did see São Paulo as, in a sense, another nation or another version of the Brazilian nation. As one North American visitor to São Paulo in the 1920s put it, quote, "The northern boundary of the state of São Paulo divides Brazil into two sections presenting contrasts with respect to populations as sharp as those between Mexico and the United States." What is particularly striking is that this racialization of regional difference occurred even as Brazil was entering the heyday of the discourse of racial democracy, based on the well-known claim that Brazil lacked the sort of racial hatred, segregation, and discrimination that was so evident in the United States at the time. At the very time that Gilberto Freire, a very distinguished Brazilian scholar of the era, was writing what was translated into English as The Masters and the Slaves, widely regarded as the foundational text of racial democracy, Paulistas with access to the public sphere continued to construct their region as historically, culturally, racially exceptional. Moreover, such an image had become so powerful even beyond the boundaries of São Paulo, that it had become common knowledge that the Paulistas were not like other Brazilians, for better or for worse. Now, what I want to do is kind of illustrate my argument by focusing on three significant moments in the construction and reproduction of Paulista regional identity. And let me say, because of time limits, I may actually, in fact, only end up talking about two examples of it and not get to the third. But the first, in the 1920s, is the emergence of the Bandeirante myth, which I will talk about, myth of origin, which I'll talk about in a minute. The second is the mobilization in the early 1930s against the regime of Getúlio Vargas, which culminated in that civil war I talked about that took place in 1932. Third, the 1954 commemorations of the quadricentennial of São Paulo's founding. I would argue that the consistent association between São Paulo's success and its alleged whiteness reinforced an undercurrent of racism that has made racial democracy seem more like a myth or an aspiration rather than a description of actual race relations in Brazil. So this first section is becoming the povo bandeirante, which is a phrase that's, povo is like pueblo in Spanish, it means the people, and so it's the bandeirante people. There are a variety of factors that contributed to the flowering of Paulista regional identity after the installation of the first Brazilian Republic in 1889. But for the sake of brevity, I will focus on the one that I think had the most impact in terms of making Paulista identity something that could be easily described and portrayed, and that is the myth, of the Bandeirante. Paulista intellectuals, especially historians, during the early decades of the 20th century, can be credited with the successful construction of a foundational myth of origin, one that positioned São Paulo not only as crucial to the formation of the Brazilian nation, but also as qualitatively different from the rest of the nation. The myth of origin became the foundation of regionalist narratives that define São Paulo as not only more prosperous than other regions, but as historically distinctive. The Paulista elites regarded Brazil beyond São Paulo's border as a fundamentally backward nation, weighed down by a colonial legacy of declining Portuguese power, unenlightened monarchy, and plantation slavery. So it's fascinating for me to look at the way in which there's a kind of real contest between historians in this period, in the early 20th century, over how to think about the sort of roots of Brazilian national identity. And so somebody like Gilberto Freire, who I mentioned before, who is from the Northeast, is thinking of Brazilian identity in terms of its origins in the sugar, the slave plantations of the sugar-growing region of the Northeast. And the Paulistas see that area as the source of all the problems that Brazil has. And they are arguing that the reason they are such a successful society is because their colonial experience, their historical origins, are very different from that society. Plantation slavery as a colonial legacy was particularly problematic from the Paulistas' point of view, since it endowed Brazil with a feudal system of great estates and a population that was heavily of African descent. And while Brazilian intellectuals by the 1920s, unlike their European counterparts, rarely regarded these legacies as fatal flaws. Most Brazilian intellectuals, even in São Paulo, would not say that they are condemned forever to backwardness because they are not a white nation. Virtually every major elite figure embraced the desirability of whitening or civilizing the population through European immigration. In other words, modernity was not generally seen as imminent in the Brazilian nation, traditionally defined. Rather, it would either have to come from outside Brazil, as in European immigration, or from outside the dominant historical trajectory of colonial Brazil. So São Paulo can be modern because it doesn't share the same colonial past.